Chapter 7. Tel Aviv. Dina had lapsed into a long silence. Yossi and Ramona, entranced, watched her with the intensity of small children. Even Yaakov seemed to have fallen under her spell, not because he had been converted to Dina's cause, but because he wanted to know where the story was taking them. Gabriel, had he wished, could have told him. And when Dina placed a new image on the screen, a strikingly handsome man seated in an outdoor cafe wearing wraparound sunglasses, Gabriel saw it not in the grainy black and white of the photograph, but as the scene appeared in his own memory. Oil on canvas, abraded and yellowed with age. Dina began to speak again, but Gabriel was no longer listening. He was scrubbing away at the soiled varnish of his memory, watching a younger version of himself rushing across the blood-stained courtyard of a Parisian apartment building with a Beretta in his hand.
"This is Sabri al-Khalifa," Dina was saying. "The setting is the Boulevard Saint-Germain in Paris. The year is 1979. The photograph was snapped by an office surveillance team. It was the last ever taken of him."
Amman Jordan, June 1967. It was 11 in the morning when the handsome young man with pale skin and black hair walked into a Fatah recruiting office in downtown Amman. The officer seated behind the desk in the lobby was in a foul mood. The entire Arab world was. The Second War for Palestine had just ended. Instead of liberating the land from the Jews, it had precipitated yet another catastrophe for the Palestinians. In just 6 days, the Israeli military had routed the combined armies of Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. Sinai, the Golan Heights, and the West Bank were now in Jewish hands, and thousands more Palestinians had been turned into refugees. "Name?" the recruiter snapped.
"Sabri al-Khalifa."
The Fatah man looked up, startled.
"Yes, of course you are," he said. "I fought with your father. Come with me."
Sabri was immediately placed in a car and chauffeured at high speed across the Jordanian capital to a safe house. There, he was introduced to a small, unimpressive-looking man named Yasser Arafat.
"I've been waiting for you," Arafat said. "I knew your father. He was a great man."
Sabri smiled. He was used to hearing compliments about his father. All his life he'd been told stories about the heroic deeds of the great warlord from Beit Said, and how the Jews, to punish the villagers who had supported his father, razed the village and forced its inhabitants into exile. Sabri al-Khalifa had little in common with most of his refugee brethren. He'd been raised in a pleasant district of Beirut and educated at the finest schools and universities in Europe. Along with his native Arabic, he spoke French, German, and English fluently. His cosmopolitan upbringing had made him a valuable asset to the Palestinian cause. Yasser Arafat wasn't about to let him go to waste.
"Fatah is riddled with traitors and collaborators," Arafat said. "Every time we send an assault team across the border, the Jews are lying in wait. If we're ever going to be an effective fighting force, we have to purge the traitors from our midst. I would think a job such as that would appeal to you, given what happened to your father. He was undone by a collaborator, was he not?"
Sabri nodded gravely. He'd been told that story, too.
"Will you work for me?" Arafat said. "Will you fight for your people like your father did?"
Sabri immediately went to work for the Jihaz al-Razd, the intelligence branch of Fatah. Within a month of accepting the assignment, he'd unmasked 20 Palestinian collaborators. Sabri made a point of attending their executions and always personally fired a symbolic coup de grace into each victim as a warning to those considering treason against the revolution. After 6 months at the Jihaz al-Razd, Sabri was summoned to a second meeting with Yasser Arafat. This one took place in a different safe house from the first. The Fatah leader fearful of Israeli assassins, slept in a different bed every night. Though Sabri didn't know it then, he would soon be living the same way.
"We have plans for you," Arafat said. "Very special plans. You will be a great man. Your feats will rival even those of your father. Soon the whole world will know the name Sabri al-Khalifa."
"What sort of plans?"
"In due time, Sabri. First, we must prepare you."
He was sent to Cairo for 6 months of intense terrorist training under the tutelage of the Egyptian secret service, the Mukhabarat. While in Cairo, he was introduced to a young Palestinian woman named Rima, the daughter of a senior Fatah officer. It seemed a perfect match, and the two were hastily married in a private ceremony attended only by Fatah members and officers of Egyptian intelligence. A month later, Sabri was recalled to Jordan to begin the next phase of his preparation. He left Rima in Cairo with her father, and though he didn't realize it at the time, she was pregnant with a son. The date of his birth was an ominous one for the Palestinians. September 1970. For some time, King Hussein of Jordan had been concerned about the growing power of the Palestinians living in his midst. The western portion of his country had become a virtual state within a state, with a chain of refugee camps ruled by heavily armed Fatah militants who openly flouted the authority of the Hashemite monarch. Hussein, who had lost half his kingdom already, feared he would lose the rest unless he removed the Palestinians from Jordanian soil. In September 1970, he ordered his fierce Bedouin soldiers to do precisely that. Arafat's fighters were no match for the Bedouin. Thousands were massacred, and once more the Palestinians were scattered, this time to camps in Lebanon and Syria. Arafat wanted revenge against the Jordanian monarch and against all those who had betrayed the Palestinian people. He wanted to carry out bloody and spectacular acts of terrorism on the world stage, acts that would place the plight of the Palestinians before a global audience and quench the Palestinian thirst for revenge. The attacks would be carried out by a secret unit, so the PLO could maintain the charade that it was a respectable revolutionary army fighting for the liberation of an oppressed people. Abu Iyad, Arafat's number two, was given overall command. But the operational mastermind would be the son of the great Palestinian warlord from Beit Said, Sabri al-Khalifa. The unit would be called Black September, to honor the Palestinian dead in Jordan. Sabri recruited a small elite force from the best units of Fatah. In the tradition of his father, he selected men like himself, Palestinians from notable families who had seen more of the world than the refugee camps. Next, he set out for Europe, where he assembled a network of educated Palestinian exiles. He also established links with leftist European terror groups and intelligence services behind the Iron Curtain. By November 1971, Black September was ready to emerge from the shadows. At the top of Sabri's hit list was King Hussein's Jordan. The blood flowed first in the city where Sabri had served his apprenticeship. The Jordanian Prime Minister, on a visit to Cairo, was gunned down in the lobby of the Sheraton Hotel. More attacks followed in quick succession. The car of the Jordanian ambassador was ambushed in London. Jordanian aircraft were hijacked, and Jordanian airline offices were firebombed. In Bonn, five Jordanian intelligence officers were butchered in the cellar of a house. After settling the score with Jordan, Sabri turned his attention to the true enemies of the Palestinian people, the Zionists of Israel. In May 1972, Black September hijacked a Sabena Airlines jet and forced it to land at Israel's Lod airport. A few days later, terrorists from the Japanese Red Army, acting on Black September's behalf, attacked passengers in the arrival hall at Lod with machine gun fire and hand grenades, killing 27 people. Letter bombs were mailed to Israeli diplomats and prominent Jews across Europe. But Sabri's greatest terrorist triumph was still to come. Early on the morning of September 5, 1972, 2 years after the expulsion from Jordan, 6 Palestinian terrorists scaled the fence at the Olympic Village in Munich, Germany, and entered the apartment building at Connollystrasse 31, which housed members of the Israeli Olympic team. 2 Israelis were killed in the initial assault. 9 others were rounded up and taken hostage. For the next 20 hours, with 900 million people around the world watching on television, the German government negotiated with the terrorists for the release of the Israeli hostages. Deadlines came and went, until finally, at 10:10 p.m., the terrorists and the hostages boarded 2 helicopters and took off for Fürstenfeldbruck airfield. Shortly after arriving, West German forces launched an ill-conceived and poorly planned rescue operation. All 9 of the hostages were massacred by the Black Septembrists. Jubilation swept the Arab world. Sabri al-Khalifa, who had monitored the operation from a safe flat in East Berlin, was greeted as a conquering hero upon his return to Beirut. "You are my son," Arafat said as he threw his arms around Sabri. "You are my son." In Tel Aviv, Prime Minister Golda Meir ordered her intelligence chiefs to avenge the Munich 11 by hunting down and killing the members of Black September. Codenamed Wrath of God, the operation would be led by Ari Shamron, the same man who had been given the task of ending Sheikh Assad's bloody reign of terror in 1948. For the second time in 25 years, Shamron was ordered to kill a man named al-Khalifa. Dina left the room in darkness and told the rest of the story as though Gabriel were not seated 10 feet away from her at the opposite end of the table. "One by one, the members of Black September were methodically hunted down and killed by Shamron's Wrath of God teams. In all, 12 members were killed by office assassins, but Sabri al-Khalifa, the one Shamron wanted most, remained beyond his reach. Sabri fought back. He killed an office agent in Madrid. He attacked the Israeli embassy in Bangkok and murdered the American ambassador to Sudan. His attacks became more erratic, as did his behavior. Arafat was no longer able to maintain the fiction that he had no connection to Black September, and condemnation rained down upon him, even from quarters sympathetic to his cause. Sabri had brought disgrace to the movement, but Arafat still doted on him like a son." Dina paused and looked at Gabriel. His face, lit by the glow of Sabri al-Khalifa's image on the projection screen, showed no emotion. His gaze was downward toward his hands, which were folded neatly on the tabletop. "Would you care to finish the story?" she asked. Gabriel spent a moment contemplating his hands before taking up Dina's invitation to speak. "Shamron learned through an informant that Sabri kept a girl in Paris, a left-wing journalist named Denise, who believed he was a Palestinian poet and freedom fighter. Sabri had neglected to tell Denise that he was a married man with a child. Shamron briefly considered trying to enroll her, but gave up on the idea. It seemed the poor girl was truly in love with Sabri. So we sent the teams to Paris and put a watch on her instead. A month later, Sabri came to town to see her." He paused and looked up at the screen. "He arrived at her apartment in the middle of the night. It was too dark to confirm his identity, so Shamron decided to take a chance and wait until we could get a better look at him. They stayed in the apartment making love until the late afternoon. Then they went to lunch in a café on the Boulevard Saint-Germain. That's when we snapped that photo. After lunch, they walked back to her apartment. It was still light, but Shamron gave the order to take him down." Gabriel lapsed into silence, and once more his gaze turned down toward his hands. He
He closed his eyes briefly. I followed them on foot. He had his left arm around the girl's waist, and his hand was shoved into the back pocket of her jeans. His right hand was in his jacket pocket. That's where he always kept his gun. He turned and looked at me once, but kept walking. He and the girl had drunk 2 bottles of wine over lunch. I suppose his senses weren't terribly sharp at the time. Another silence, then, after a glance at Sabri's face, another meditation over his hands. His voice, when he spoke again, had an air of detachment, as if he were describing the exploits of another man. They paused at the entrance. Denise was drunk and laughing. She was looking down into her purse, looking for the key. Sabri was telling her to hurry up. He wanted to get her clothes off again. I could have done it there, but there were too many people on the street, so I slowed down and waited for her to find the damned key. I passed by them as she slid it into the lock. Sabri looked at me again, and I looked back. They stepped into the passageway. I turned and caught the door before it could close. Sabri and the girl were in the middle of the courtyard by now. He heard my footfall and turned around. His hand was coming out of his coat pocket, and I could see the butt. Sabri carried a Stecken. It was a gift from a friend in the KGB. I hadn't drawn my gun yet. Shamron's rule, we called it.
We do not walk around in the street like gangsters with our guns drawn, Shamron always said. 1 second, Gabriel. That's all you'll have. 1 second. Only a man with truly gifted hands can get his gun off his hip and into firing position in 1 second.
Gabriel looked around the room and held the gaze of each team member briefly before resuming. The Beretta had an 8-shot magazine, but I discovered that if I packed the rounds in tightly, I could squeeze in 10. Sabri never got his gun into position. He was turning to face me as I fired. His target profile was reduced. I think my first and second shots hit him in the left arm. I moved forward and put him on the ground. The girl was screaming, hitting me across the back with her handbag. I put 10 shots in him, then released the magazine and rammed my back up into the butt. It had only 1 round, the 11th. 1 round for every Jew Sabri murdered at Munich. I put the barrel into his ear and fired. The girl collapsed over his body and called me a murderer. I went back through the passageway, out into the street. A motorcycle pulled up. I climbed on the back. Only Yakov, who had seen his share of killing operations in the occupied territories, dared break the silence that had descended over the room.
What do Assad al-Khalifa and his boy Sabri have to do with Rome?
Gabriel looked at Dina, and with his eyes posed the same question. Dina removed the photograph of Sabri and replaced it with the one showing Khaled at his father's funeral. When Sabri's wife, Rima, heard that he'd been killed in Paris, she walked into the bathroom of her apartment in Beirut and slit her wrists. Khaled found his mother lying on the floor in a pool of her own blood. He was now an orphan, his parents dead, his clan scattered to the four winds. Arafat adopted the boy, and after the funeral, Khaled disappeared.
Where did he go? Asked Yossi.
Arafat saw the child as a potent symbol of the revolution and wanted him protected at all costs. We think he shipped him off to Europe under an assumed name to live with a wealthy Palestinian exile family. What we do know is this. In 25 years, Khaled al-Khalifa has never resurfaced. 2 years ago, I asked Lev for permission to start a quiet search for him. I can't find him. It's as if he vanished into thin air after the funeral. It's as if he's dead, too.
And your theory?
I believe Arafat prepared him to follow in the footsteps of his famous father and grandfather. I believe he's been activated.
Why?
Because Arafat is trying to make himself relevant again, and he's doing it the only way he knows how, with violence and terrorism. He's using Khaled as his weapon.
You have no proof, said Yaakov. There's a terrorist cell in Europe preparing to hit us again. We can't afford to waste time looking for a phantom.
Dina placed a new photograph on the overhead projector. It showed the wreckage of a building.
Buenos Aires, 1994. A truck bomb flattens the Jewish community center during a Shabbat meal. 87 dead. No claim of responsibility.
A new slide. More wreckage.
Istanbul, 2003. Two car bombs explode simultaneously outside the city's main synagogue. 28 dead. No claim of responsibility.
Dina turned to Yossi and asked him to turn on the lights.
You told me you had evidence linking Khaled to Rome, Gabriel said, squinting in the sudden brightness. But thus far, you've given me nothing but conjecture.
Oh, but I do have evidence, Gabriel.
So, what's the connection?
Beit Said.
They set out from King Saul Boulevard in an office transit van a few minutes before dawn. The windows of the van were tinted and bulletproof, and so inside it remained dark long after the sky began to grow light. By the time they reached Petah Tikva, the sun was peeking over the ridgeline of the Judean hills. It was a modern suburb of Tel Aviv now, with large homes and green lawns. But Gabriel, as he peered out the tinted windows, pictured the original stone cottages and Russian settlers huddled against yet another pogrom, this one led by Sheikh Assad and his holy warriors. Beyond Petah Tikva lay a broad plain of open farmland. Dina directed the driver onto a two-lane road that ran along the edge of a new superhighway. They followed the road for a few miles, then turned into a dirt track bordering a newly planted orchard.
Here, she said suddenly. Stop here.
The van rolled to a stop. Dina climbed down and hastened into the trees. Gabriel came next, Yossi and Ramona at his shoulder, Yaakov trailing a few paces behind. They came to the end of the orchard. 50 yards in the distance lay a field of row crops. Between the orchard and field was a wasteland overgrown with green winter grass. Dina stopped and turned to face the others.
Welcome to Beit Said, she said.
She beckoned them forward. It soon became apparent they were walking amid the remains of the village. Its footprint was clearly visible in the gray earth. The cottages and the stone walls, the little square and the circular wellhead. Gabriel had seen villages like it in the Jezreel Valley and the Galilee. No matter how hard the new owners of the land tried to erase the Arab villages, the footprint remained, like the memory of a dead child. Dina stopped next to the wellhead and the others gathered round her.
On April 18, 1948, at approximately 7 o'clock in the evening, a Palmach brigade surrounded Beit Said. After a brief firefight, the Arab militiamen fled, leaving the village undefended. Wholesale panic ensued. And why not? 3 days earlier, more than 100 residents of Deir Yassin had been killed by members of the Ergun and Stern gang. Needless to say, the Arabs of Beit Said weren't anxious to meet a similar fate. It probably didn't take much encouragement to get them to pack their bags and flee. When the village was deserted, the Palmach men dynamited the houses.
What's the connection with Rome?
Yaakov asked impatiently.
Daoud Hadawi.
By the time Hadawi was born, this place had been wiped from the face of the earth.
That's true, Dina said. Hadawi was born in the Jenin refugee camp, but his clan came from here. His grandmother, his father, and various aunts, uncles, and cousins fled Beit Said the night of April 18, 1948.
And his grandfather? Asked Gabriel.
He'd been killed a few days earlier, near Lida. You see, Daoud Hadawi's grandfather was one of Sheikh Assad's most trusted men. He was guarding the Sheikh the night Shamron killed him. He was the one Shamron stabbed before entering the cottage.
That's all? Asked Yakov.
Dina shook her head.
The bombings in Buenos Aires and Istanbul both took place on April 18th at 7 o'clock.
My God, murmured Ramona.
There's one more thing,
Dina said, turning to Gabriel.
The date you killed Sabri in Paris. Do you remember it?
It was early March, he said, but I can't remember the date.
It was March 4th,
Dina said. The same day as Rome, said Ramona.
That's right.
Dina looked around at the remnants of the old village.
It started right here, in Beit Said, more than 50 years ago. It was Khaled who masterminded Rome, and he's going to hit us again in 28 days.
Part 2. The Collaborator. Chapter 8. Near Aix-en-Provence, France.
I think we may have found another one, Professor.
Paul Martineau, crouched on all fours in the deep shadows of the excavation pit, twisted his head slowly round and searched for the origin of the voice that had disturbed his work. It fell upon the familiar form of Yvette Debray, a young graduate student who had volunteered for the dig. Lit from behind by the sharp mid-morning Provençal sun, she was a mere silhouette. Martineau had always considered her something of a well-concealed artifact. Her short, dark hair and square features left the impression of an adolescent boy. Only when his eye traveled down her body, across the ample breasts, the slender waist, the rounded hips, was her remarkable beauty fully revealed. He had probed her body with his skilled hands, sifted the soil of its secret corners, and found hidden delights and the pain of ancient wounds. No one else on the dig suspected their relationship was anything more than professor and pupil. Paul Martineau was very good at keeping secrets.
Where is it?
Behind the meeting house.
Real or stone?
Stone.
The attitude?
Face up.
Martineau stood. Then he placed his palms on either side of the narrow pit, and with a powerful thrust of his shoulders, pushed himself back up to the surface. He patted the reddish Provençal earth from his palms and smiled at Yvette. He was dressed, as usual, in faded denim jeans and suede boots that were cut a bit more stylishly than those favored by lesser archaeologists. His woolen pullover was charcoal gray, and a crimson handkerchief was knotted rakishly at his throat. His hair was dark and curly, his eyes were large and deep brown. A colleague had once remarked that in Paul Martineau's face one could see traces of all the peoples who had once held sway in Provence. The Celts and the Gauls, the Greeks and the Romans, the Visigoths and the Teutons, the Franks and the Arabs. He was undeniably handsome. Yvette Debray had not been the first admiring graduate student to be seduced by him. Officially, Martineau was an adjunct professor of archaeology at the prestigious University of Aix-Marseille-Troyes, though he spent most of his time in the field and served as an advisor to more than a dozen local archaeological museums scattered across the south of France. He was an expert on the pre-Roman history of Provence, and, although only 35, was regarded as one of the finest French archaeologists of his generation. His last paper, A Treatment on the Demise of Ligurian Hegemony in Provence, had been declared the standard academic work on the subject. Currently, he was in negotiation with a French publisher for a mass-market work on the ancient history of the region. His success, his women, and rumors of wealth had made him the source of considerable professional resentment and gossip. Martineau, though hardly talkative about his personal life, had never made a secret of his provenance. His late father, Henri Martineau, had dabbled in business and diplomacy and failed spectacularly at both. Martineau, upon the death of his mother, had sold the family's large home in Avignon, along with a second property in the rural Vaucluse. He had been living comfortably on the proceeds ever since. He had a large flat near the university in Aix, a comfortable villa in the Luberian village of Lacoste, and a small pied-à-terre in Montmartre in Paris. When asked why he had chosen archaeology, he would reply that he was fascinated by the question of why civilizations came and went and what brought about their demise. Others sensed in him a certain restiveness, a quiet fury that seemed to be calmed, at least temporarily, by physically plunging his hands into the past. Martineau followed the girl through the maze of excavation trenches. Located atop a mount overlooking the broad plain of the Chêne de la Toile, the site was an oppidum, or walled hill fort, built by the powerful Celto-Ligurian tribe known as the Salias. Initial excavations had concluded that the fort contained two distinct sections, one for a Celtic aristocracy, and another for what was thought to be a Ligurian underclass. But Martineau had put forward a new theory. The hasty addition of the poorer section of the fort had coincided with a round of fighting between the Ligurians and the Greeks near Marseille. On this dig, Martineau had proven conclusively that the annex had been the equivalent of an Iron Age refugee camp. Now he sought to answer three questions. Why had the hill fort been abandoned after only 100 years? What was the significance of the large number of severed heads, some real and some rendered in stone, that he had discovered in the vicinity of the central meeting house? Were they merely the battle trophies of a barbarian Iron Age people? Or were they religious in nature, linked somehow to the mysterious Celtic severed head cult? Martineau suspected the cult may have had a hand in the hill fort's rapid demise, which is why he had ordered the other members of the team to alert him the moment a head was discovered, and why he handled the excavations personally. He had learned through hard experience that no clue, no matter how insignificant, could be ignored. What was the disposition of the head? What other artifacts or fragments were found in the vicinity? Was there trace evidence contained in the surrounding soil? Such matters could not be left in the hands of a graduate student, even one as talented as Yvette Debray. They arrived at an excavation trench about 6 feet in length and shoulder-width across. Martineau lowered himself in, careful not to disturb the surrounding earth. Protruding from the hard subsoil was the easily recognizable shape of a human nose. Martineau, from his back pocket, removed a small hand pick and a brush and went to work. For the next 6 hours, he did not rise from his pit. Yvette sat cross-legged at the edge. Occasionally, she offered him mineral water or coffee, which he refused. Every few minutes, one of the other team members would wander by and inquire about his progress. Their questions were met by silence. Only the sound of Martineau's work emanated from the trench. Pick, pick, brush, brush, blow. Pick, pick, brush, brush, blow. Slowly the face rose toward him from the depths of the ancient soil, mouth drawn in final anguish, eyes closed in death. As the morning wore on, he probed deeper into the soil and found, as he had expected, that the head was held by a hand. Those gathered on the edge of the excavation trench did not realize that for Paul Martineau, the face represented more than an intriguing artifact from the distant past. Martineau, in the dark soil, saw the face of his enemy. And one day soon, he thought, he too would be holding a severed head in the palm of his hand. The storm came down from the Rhône Valley at midday. The rain, cold and driven by a harsh wind, swept over the excavation site like a vandal raiding party. Martineau climbed out of his trench and hastened up the hill, where he found the rest of his team sheltering in the lee of the ancient wall. "Pack up,"
he said. We'll try again tomorrow. Martineau bid them good day and started toward the car park. Yvette detached herself from the others and followed after him.
How about dinner tonight?
I'd love to, but I'm afraid I can't.
Why not?
Another dreary faculty reception, Martineau said. The dean has demanded my presence.
Tomorrow night?
Perhaps. Martineau touched her hand. See you in the morning. On the opposite side of the wall was a grassy car park. Martineau's new Mercedes sedan stood out from the battered cars and motor scooters of the volunteers and the less noteworthy archaeologists working on the dig. He climbed behind the wheel and set out along the D-14 toward Aix. 15 minutes later, he was pulling into a parking space outside his apartment house, just off the Cours Mirabeau in the heart of the city. It was a fine 18th-century house, with an iron balcony on each window and a door on the left side of the façade facing the street. Martineau removed his post from the mailbox, then rode the small lift up to the fourth floor. It emptied into a small vestibule with a marble floor. The pair of Roman water vessels that stood outside his door were real, though anyone who asked about their origin was told they were clever reproductions. The apartment he entered seemed more suited to a member of the Aixois aristocracy than an archaeologist and part-time professor. Originally, it had been two apartments, but Martineau, after the untimely accidental death of his widower neighbor, had won the right to combine them into a single flat. The living room was large and dramatic, with a high ceiling and large windows overlooking the street. The furnishings were Provençal in style, though less rustic than the pieces at his villa in Lacoste. On one wall was a landscape by Cézanne. On another, a pair of sketches by Degas. A pair of remarkably intact Roman pillars flanked the entrance to a large study, which contained several hundred archaeological monographs, and a remarkable collection of original field notes and manuscripts from some of the greatest minds in the history of the discipline. Martineau's home was his sanctuary. He never invited colleagues here. Only women, and lately, only Yvette. He showered quickly and changed into clean clothing. 2 minutes later, he was behind the wheel of the Mercedes once more, speeding along the Cours Mirabeau. He did not drive toward the university. Instead, he made his way across the city and turned onto the A51 autoroute toward Marseille. He had lied to Yvette. It was not the first time. Most Aixois tended to turn up their nose at Marseille. Paul Martineau had always been seduced by it. The port city the Greeks had called Massilia was now the second largest in France, and it remained the point of entry for the majority of immigrants to the country, most of whom now came from Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia. Divided roughly in half by the thunderous Boulevard de la Canebière, it had two distinct faces. South of the boulevard, on the edge of the old port, lay a pleasant French city with broad pedestrian walks, exclusive shopping streets, and esplanades dotted with outdoor cafes. But to the north were the districts known as Le Panier and the Quartier Belsens. Here it was possible to walk the pavements and hear only Arabic. Foreigners and native Frenchmen, easy prey for street criminals, rarely strayed into the Arab neighborhoods after dark. Paul Martineau had no such misgivings about his security. He left his Mercedes on the Boulevard Dathiné, near the base of the steps that led to the St. Charles train station, and set out down the hill toward Rue de la Canebière. Before reaching the thoroughfare, he turned right into a narrow street called the Rue des Convalescents. Barely wide enough to accommodate a car, it sloped downward toward the port, into the heart of the Quartier Belsens. It was dark in the street, and Martineau, at his back, felt the first gusts of a mistral. The night air smelled of charcoal smoke and turmeric, and faintly of honey. A pair of old men, seated on spindly chairs outside the doorway of a tenement house, shared a hubble-bubble water pipe and studied Martineau indifferently as he trod past. A moment later,
a soccer ball, deflated and nearly the color of the pavement, bounded toward him out of the darkness. Martineau put a foot on it and sent it adroitly back in the direction from which it came. It was scooped up by a sandaled boy, who, upon seeing the tall stranger in western clothes, turned and vanished into the mouth of an alleyway. Martineau had a vision of himself 30 years earlier.
Charcoal smoke, turmeric, honey.
For an instant, he felt as though he was walking the streets of South Beirut. He came to an intersection of two streets. On one corner was a shawarma stand, on another a tiny café that promised cuisine tunisienne. A trio of teenage boys eyed Martineau provocatively from the doorway of the café. In French, he wished them good evening, then lowered his gaze and turned to the right. The street was narrower than the Rue des Convalescents, and most of the pavement was consumed by market stalls filled with cheap carpets and aluminum pots. At the other end was an Arab coffee house. Martineau went inside. At the back of the coffee house, near the toilet, was a narrow flight of unlit stairs. Martineau climbed slowly upward through the gloom. At the top was a door. As Martineau approached, it swung open suddenly. A man, clean-shaven and dressed in a galabia gown, stepped onto the landing.
"Masalama," he said, "peace be upon you."
"Assalamu alaikum," replied Martineau as he slipped past the man and entered the apartment. Chapter 9. Jerusalem. Jerusalem is quite literally a city on a hill. It stands high atop the Judean mountains and is reached from the coastal plain by a staircase-like road that climbs through the twisting mountain gorge known as the Sha'ar Haggai. Gabriel, like most Israelis, still referred to it by its Arab name, the Bab al-Wad. He lowered the window of his office Skoda and rested his arm in the opening. The evening air, cool and soft and scented with cypress and pine, tugged at his shirt sleeve. He passed the rusted carcass of an armored personnel carrier, a memorial relic of the fighting in 1948, and thought of Sheikh Assad and his campaign to sever the lifeline to Jerusalem. He switched on the radio, hoping to find a bit of music to take his mind off the case, but instead heard a bulletin that a suicide bomber had just struck a bus in the affluent Jerusalem neighborhood of Rehavia. He listened to the updates for a time, then, when the somber music began, he switched off the radio. Somber music meant fatalities. The more music, the higher the number of dead. Highway 1 changed suddenly from a four-lane motorway into a broad urban boulevard, the famed Jaffa Road, that ran from the northwest corner of Jerusalem to the walls of the old city. Gabriel followed the road to the left, then down a long, gentle sweep, past the chaotic new central bus station. In spite of the bombing, commuters streamed across the road toward the entrance. Most had no choice but to board their bus and hope that tonight the roulette ball didn't land on their number. He passed the entrance of the sprawling Makane Yehuda market. An Ethiopian girl in police uniform stood watch at a metal barricade, checking the bag of each person who entered. When Gabriel stopped for a traffic light, clusters of black-coated Haredi men drifted between the cars like swirling leaves. A series of turns brought him to Narkis Street. There were no parking spaces to be had, so he left the car around the corner and walked slowly back to his apartment beneath the protective awning of the eucalyptus trees. He had a bittersweet memory of Venice, of gliding home upon the silken waters of a canal and tying his boat to the dock at the back of his house. The Jerusalem limestone apartment block was set back a few meters from the street and reached by a cement walkway through a tangled little garden. The foyer was lit by a greenish light and smelled heavily of new oil-based paint. He didn't bother checking the mailbox. No one knew he lived there, and the utility bills went directly to an ersatz property management company run by housekeeping. The block contained no elevator. Gabriel climbed the cement stairs wearily to the fourth floor and opened the door.
The flat was large by Israeli standards. Two bedrooms, a galley kitchen, a small study off the combination living room and dining room, but a far cry from the piano nobile of Gabriel's canal house in Venice. Housekeeping had offered to sell it to him. The value of Jerusalem apartments seemed to sink with each suicide bombing, and at the moment it could be had for a good price. Chiara had decided not to wait for a deed to make it her own. With little else to do, she spent much of her time shopping and was steadily turning the functional but cheerless place into something like a home. A new rug had appeared since Gabriel had been home. So had a circular brass coffee table with a lacquered wood pedestal. He'd hoped she'd bought it somewhere reputable and not from one of those hucksters who sold Holy Land air in a bottle. He called Chiara's name, but received only silence in reply. He wandered down the hall to their bedroom. It had been furnished for operatives rather than lovers. Gabriel had pushed the twin beds together, but invariably he would awaken in the middle of the night to find himself falling into the crevasse, clinging to the edge of the precipice. At the foot of the bed rested a small cardboard box. Chiara had packed away most of their things. This was all that remained. He supposed the psychologist at King Saul Boulevard would have read deep analytical insight into his failure to unpack the box. The truth was far more prosaic. He'd been too busy at work. Still, it was depressing to think that his entire life could fit into this box, just as it is hard to fathom a small metallic urn can contain the ashes of a human being. Most of the things weren't even his. They'd belonged to Mario Del Vecchio, a role he'd played for some time to moderate acclaim. He sat down and, with his thumbnail, sliced open the packing tape. He was relieved to find a small wooden case, the traveling restoration kit containing pigments and brushes that Umberto Conti had given him as a gift at the end of his apprenticeship. The rest was mainly rubbish, things with which he should have parted long ago. Old check stubs, notes on restorations, a harsh review he'd received in an Italian art magazine for his work on Tintoretto's Christ on the Sea of Galilee. He wondered why he'd bothered to read it, let alone keep it. At the bottom of the box, he found a manila envelope, no bigger than a checkbook. He loosened the flap and turned the envelope over. Out fell a pair of eyeglasses. They had belonged to Benjamin Stern, a former office agent who'd been murdered. Gabriel could still make out Benjamin's oily fingerprints on the dirty lenses. He started to place the glasses back into the envelope, but noticed something lodged at the bottom. He turned it over and tapped on the base. An object fell to the floor, a strand of leather on which hung a piece of red coral shaped like a hand. Just then, he heard Chiara's footfalls on the landing. He scooped up the talisman and slipped it into his pocket. By the time he arrived in the front room, she'd managed to get the door open and was in the process of carrying several bags of groceries over the threshold. She looked up at Gabriel and smiled, as though surprised to find him there. Her dark hair was braided into a heavy plait, and the early spring Mediterranean sun had left a trace of color across her cheeks. She looked to Gabriel like a native-born Sabra. Only when she spoke Hebrew with her outrageous Italian accent did she betray her country of origin. Gabriel no longer spoke to her in Italian. Italian was the language of Mario, and Mario was dead. Only in bed did they speak to each other in Italian, and that was a concession to Chiara, who believed Hebrew was not a proper language for lovers. Gabriel closed the door and helped carry the plastic bags of groceries into the kitchen. They were mismatched, some white, some blue, a pinkish bag bearing the name of a well-known kosher butcher. He knew Chiara once again had ignored his admonition to stay out of the Makane Yehuda market.
"Everything is better there, especially the produce," she said defensively, reading the look of disapproval on his face. "Besides, I like the atmosphere. It's so intense."
"Yes," Gabriel agreed. "You should see it when a bomb goes off.
Are you saying that the great Gabriel Alon is afraid of suicide bombers?
Yes, I am. You can't stop living, but there are sensible things you can do. How did you get home?
Kiara looked at him sheepishly.
Damn it, Kiara! I couldn't find a cab.
Do you know a bus was just bombed in Rehavia?
Of course. We heard the explosion inside Makane Yehuda. That's why I decided to take the bus home. I figured the odds were in my favor.
Such macabre calculations, Gabriel knew, were a daily facet of modern Israeli life.
From now on, take bus number 11.
Which one is that?
He pointed two fingers toward the floor and moved them in a walking motion.
Is that an example of your fatalistic Israeli sense of humor?
You have to keep a sense of humor in this country. It's the only way to keep from going crazy.
I liked you better when you were an Italian.
She pushed him gently from the kitchen.
Go take a shower. We're having guests for dinner.
Ari Shamron had alienated all those who loved him most. He had wagered, foolishly as it turned out, that his lifelong commitment to the defense of his country granted him immunity when it came to his children and his friends. His son, Yonatan, was a tank commander in the Israeli Defense Forces and seemed gripped by an almost suicidal need to die in battle. His daughter had moved to New Zealand and was living on a chicken farm with a Gentile. She avoided his calls and refused his repeated demands to return to the land of her birth. Only Zhila, his long-suffering wife, had remained faithfully at his side. She was as calm as Shamron was temperamental, and blessed with a myopic ability to see only the good in him. She was the only person who ever dared to scold him, though to spare him needless embarrassment she usually did so in Polish, as she did when Shamron tried to light a cigarette at the dinner table after finishing his plate of roasted chicken and rice pilaf. She knew only the vaguest details of her husband's work, and suspected his hands were unclean. Shamron had spared her the worst, for he feared that Zhila, if she knew too much, would abandon him the way his children had. She viewed Gabriel as a restraining influence and treated him kindly. She also sensed that Gabriel loved Shamron in the turbulent way in which a son loves a father, and she loved him in return. She did not know that Gabriel had killed men on orders from her husband. She believed he was a clerk of some sort who had spent a great deal of time in Europe and knew much about art. Zhila helped Kiara with the dishes while Gabriel and Shamron adjourned to the study to talk. Shamron, shielded from Zhila's gaze, lit a cigarette. Gabriel opened the window. Night rain beat a gentle rhythm on the street, and the sharp scent of wet eucalyptus leaves filled the room.
"I hear you're chasing Khaled," Shamron said.
Gabriel nodded. He had briefed Lev on Dina's findings that morning, and Lev had immediately gone to Jerusalem to see the Prime Minister and Shamron.
"To be honest with you, I never put much stock in the Khaled myth," Shamron said. "I always assumed the boy had changed his name and had chosen to live out his life free from the shadow of his grandfather and father, free of the shadow of this land."
"So did I," said Gabriel, "but the case is compelling."
"Yes, it is. Why didn't anyone ever make the connection between the dates of Buenos Aires and Istanbul?"
"It was assumed to be a coincidence," Gabriel said. "Besides, there wasn't enough evidence to close the circle. No one ever thought to look at Beit Said until now."
"She's very good, this girl, Dina."
"I'm afraid it's something of an obsession with her."
"You're referring to the fact that she was at Dizengoff Square the day the number 5 exploded?"
"How did you know that?"
"I took the liberty of reviewing the personnel files of your team. You chose well."
"She knows a lot about you, including a few things you never told me."
"Such as?"
"I never knew it was Rabin who drove the getaway car after you killed Sheikh Assad."
"We were very close after that, Rabin and I. But I'm afraid we parted company over Oslo. Rabin believed that Arafat was down and that it was time to strike a deal. I told him Arafat was striking a deal because he was down, that Arafat intended to use Oslo as a way to wage war against us by other means. I was right, of course. For Arafat, Oslo was just another step in his phased strategy to bring about our destruction. He said so in his own words when he was speaking in Arabic to his people. Shamron closed his eyes. I take no satisfaction in being proven correct. Rabin's death was a terrible blow to me. His opponents called him a traitor and a Nazi, and then they killed him. We murdered one of our own. We succumbed to the Arab disease. He shook his head slowly. Still, I suppose it was all necessary, this delusional attempt to make peace with our sworn enemies. It steeled our spine for the steps we'll need to take if we are to survive in this land. The next subject, the demolition of Beit Said, Gabriel approached with great caution.
It was a Palmach operation, was it not?
What exactly do you want to know, Gabriel?
Were you there?
Shamron exhaled heavily, then nodded once.
We had no choice. Beit Said was a base of operations for Sheikh Assad's militia. We couldn't leave such a hostile village in our midst. After the Sheikh's death, it was necessary to deal the remnants of his force a fatal blow.
Shamron's gaze grew suddenly distant. Gabriel could see he wished to discuss the matter no further. Shamron drew heavily on his cigarette, then told Gabriel about the premonition of disaster he'd had the night before the bombing.
I knew it was something like this. I could feel it the moment it happened.
Then he corrected himself.
I could feel it before it happened.
If Khaled is trying to punish us, why didn't he kill me in Venice when he had the chance?
Maybe he intended to. Daoud Hadawi was only a few miles up the road in Milan when the Italians found him. Maybe Hadawi was the one who was supposed to kill you.
And Rome? Gabriel asked. Why did Khaled choose Rome?
Maybe it was because Rome served as the European headquarters of Black September. Shamron looked at Gabriel. Or maybe he was trying to speak directly to you.
Wadal Abdelzweiter, thought Gabriel. The Piazza Anabaliano.
Keep in mind something else, Shamron said. Within a week of the bombing, there was a massive demonstration in central Rome, not against Palestinian terror, but against us. The Europeans are the best friends the Palestinians have. The civilized world has abandoned us to our fate. We would never have come back to this land if we weren't pushed here by the hatred of Europe's Christians, and now that we're here, they won't let us fight, lest we antagonize the Arabs in their midst.
A silence fell between them. From the kitchen came the clatter of china and the gentle laughter of the women. Shamron sank lower into his chair. The patter of the rain and the strong scent of the eucalyptus trees seemed to have the effect of a sedative on him.
I brought some papers for you to sign, he said.
What sort of papers?
The kind that will quietly dissolve your marriage to Leah.
Shamron placed a hand on Gabriel's forearm.
It's been 14 years. She's lost to you. She's never coming back. It's time for you to get on with your life.
It's not as easy as that, Ari.
I don't envy you, Shamron said. When are you planning to bring her home?
Her doctor is opposed to the idea. He is concerned that being back in Israel will only make her condition worse. I finally managed to convey to him that it's non-negotiable, but he's insisting she be given adequate time to prepare for the transition.
When?
A month, Gabriel said. Maybe a bit less.
Tell her doctor she'll be well cared for here. Unfortunately, we have a fair amount of experience when it comes to treating the victims of terrorist bombs.
Shamron abruptly changed course.
Are you comfortable in this flat?
Gabriel indicated that he was.
It's big enough for a child or two.
Let's not get carried away, Ari. I'll never see 50 again.
Chiara will want children, if you marry, of course. Besides, you have to do your patriotic duty. Haven't you heard about the demographic threat? Soon we'll be a minority people between the River Jordan and the sea. The Prime Minister is encouraging all of us to contribute by having more children. Thank God for the Haredim. They're the only reason we're still in the game.
I'll try to contribute in other ways.
It's yours, you know, Shamron said.
What?
The flat.
What are you talking about?
You own it now. It was purchased on your behalf by a friend of the office.
Gabriel shook his head. He had always been amazed at Shamron's gangster-like access to money. I can't accept it.
It's too late. The deed is being sent over in the morning.
I don't want to be in anyone's debt.
It is we who are in your debt. Accept it graciously and in the spirit with which it is given.
Shamron patted Gabriel's shoulder.
And fill it with children.
Gila poked her head around the half-open door. Dessert is on the table, she said. Then she looked at Shamron and in Polish ordered him to put out his cigarette.
April 18th, he murmured, when Gila had gone.
That's not much time.
I'm already watching the clock.
It's occurred to me there's one person who might know where Khaled is.
Arafat?
He is Khaled's father. Besides, he owes you a favor. You did save his life once.
Yasser Arafat is the last person I want to see. Besides, he's a liar.
Yes, but sometimes his lies can lead us in the direction of the truth.
He's off limits. Lev would never grant me authorization.
So don't tell him.
I don't think it would be wise for me to just show up and knock on Arafat's front door. And the only way I'm going to Ramallah is in an armored personnel carrier.
Arafat doesn't really have a door. The IDF took care of that. Shamron permitted himself to smile at the sinking fortunes of his old adversary. As for the armored car, leave that to me.
Gabriel climbed into bed and inched carefully toward the middle. He reached out in the darkness and draped his arm across Kiara's abdomen. She remained motionless.
What were you and Ari talking about in the study?
The case, he replied absently.
Is that all?
He told her that the apartment was now theirs.
How did that happen?
Shamron and his moneyed friends. I'll tell housekeeping to remove the old furniture. Tomorrow you can buy us a proper bed.
Kiara's arm rose slowly. Gabriel, in the darkness, could see the talisman swinging from her fingertips.
What is this?
A Corsican good luck charm. They say it wards off the evil eye.
Where did you get it?
It's a long story.
Tell me.
It's classified.
He reached for the talisman. Kiara, with a deft movement of her hand, twirled the talisman so that it wrapped securely around her fingertips, in the manner in which Arabs often toy with their prayer beads.
A gift from one of your old lovers?
She asked.
An old enemy, actually. A man who'd been hired to kill me, and a woman I was protecting.
Anna Rolf?
Yes, Gabriel said. Anna Rolf.
Why did you keep it? She asked. To remind you of her?
Kiara, don't be ridiculous.
She tossed the talisman in his direction. The red coral hand landed on his chest.
Is something wrong, Kiara?
What were those papers that Shamron gave you before he left tonight? Or is that classified, too?
Gabriel answered the question truthfully.
Did you sign them yet?
I thought I should read them first.
You know what they say.
I'll sign them, Gabriel said.
When?
When I'm ready to sign them.
Just then the apartment block shook with the clap of a thunderous explosion. Kiara climbed out of bed and rushed to the window. Gabriel remained motionless on the bed.
It's close, she said.
Ben Yehuda Mall, I'd say. Probably a cafe.
Turn on the radio.
Just count the sirens, Kiara. You can tell how bad it is by the number of ambulances they call. A moment passed, still and deathly quiet. Gabriel closed his eyes and imagined, with the clarity of videotape, the nightmare taking place a few blocks from his new home. The first siren sounded, then a second, a third, a fourth. After 17, he lost count, for the night had become a symphony of sirens. Kiara returned to bed and clung to his chest.
"Sign the papers when you're ready," she said. "I'll be here. I'll always be here."